You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. This is episode number 83, Current Trends in Pharma and How They Will Affect You as a Statistician, an interview with Richard Zink. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician Podcast. I'm today here again with my co-host Benjamin. Hi, Benjamin. How are you doing?
Hi, Alexander. Yeah, very well. Yeah, it's coming back from vacation, so fully recovered from all the stress. So it's been nice.
Yeah, recovery. You probably had more stress with your kids than at work. So
it's a different way of stress. Yeah, sometimes you go away from the kids to go to work, and that's fine in a way. And sometimes you're looking forward to come back home to go away from work. So it's kind of no. But it was very good. It was very nice. We've been up north in Sweden, and it's been out in the nature. It's quite different to living in Berlin and the stress in the city in the middle of the huge city. So it's been really, really good.
Okay, awesome. And today we have a fellow podcaster with us. Hi, Richard. How are you doing?
Hey, guys. How's it going? Thanks for having me on.
Okay, very good. So actually, Benjamin and myself have been on Richard's podcast more than a year ago before we started. And that was very nice. And so now we can offer the return. So Richard is on our podcast, which is awesome. And as Richard has also taken over the chair of the ASA Biopharm group, we will talk today about trends in the industry and how it will or may affect us statisticians. And so, but before we dive into that, Richard, maybe you can give a little bit of background for yourself, and especially in terms of what are your goals for your tenure as a chair, as well as maybe you can promote your podcast a little bit, because if people don't have yet stumbled upon your podcast, they should do that.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I'm Richard Zink. I am the 2019 chair of the biopharmaceutical section of the American Statistical Association. And within that group, I also have some other roles. I've been doing the podcast for the biopharmaceutical section since mid-2012. So we don't post as often as the Effective Statistician. We average one episode per month, but we try to focus on topics specific to initiatives within the ASA, but also some trends or various topics that are important for statisticians working in the medical product industry. So this can be anything from estimands, data sharing, and transparency, issues for statistical programming, data quality. And this year we've had a lot of topics particular to oncology development. So immunotherapies, platform trials, and we have an episode coming up on non-proportional hazards and methodologies to address that. So I'm not working directly within the pharmaceutical industry, and I haven't for some time. I started outside of school working in the pharmaceutical industry for about 8 years. And then I made it over to SAS, where I wrote software for 7 years, and software that was specific to analyzing and visualizing data in clinical trials. And now I'm at Target Pharma Solutions, where I'm the senior director of data management and statistics. And we're what you might call, in the simplest way possible, a real-world data company. So we develop patient cohorts for specific diseases, and we work with pharmaceutical companies developing in those disease areas to answer questions about the disease itself and sort of the life cycle of the disease and see how the various treatments may come into play and how they may be used once they reach the market. So definitely a lot of learning involved, and it's pretty exciting to see how this interest in data outside of clinical trials can be used to answer questions of regulatory importance.
Awesome. Very good. Yeah, I think there we have a couple of things in common, because both Benjamin and myself, we have worked on these non-clinical studies, I would call them, in lots of different ways. And it's probably, diving directly into the topic, it's probably one of the big trends that is increasing the use of real-world evidence. And the FDA initiative about real-world evidence. Richard, where do you see the biggest use of real-world evidence in that setting? Because there's just this buzzword about RWE, and that will solve all kind of different problems. But I think I'm maybe a little bit more cautious and would say there's specific problems where RWE can play a significant role, but it will not make RCTs redundant, for example.
Sure. And I think all of the excitement around real-world data and real-world evidence, and I tend to prefer the term real-world data, because, you know, what you do with it determines whether or not, and the questions you ask determine whether or not it actually turns into some kind of evidence. But I think there certainly are places where it can be used. I don't necessarily think it's going to make clinical trials vanish per se. But there may be certain ways in which we can use real-world data information even within clinical trials. So I certainly think, you know, anytime you have questions about how a drug or therapy is going to be used sort of in the real-world setting, this certainly places where real-world data can be very informative. And I think what we've seen in some of the data that we've been able to collect and analyze, and there are recommendations for how patients may be treated or should be treated depending on the severity of disease or the types of their disease. And when you look at how various physicians may apply treatments in line with any treatment guidelines, that there may be quite a few differences there, and why those differences may exist. It's certainly interesting why that may happen, and trying to understand why that may happen. It's certainly something that we should do. Certainly understanding populations that may not enter into clinical trials. There's a lot of patients who are naturally excluded from clinical trials because of either the severity of their disease or other comorbidities they may be having. They may be taking other medications that won't let them participate. But certainly having information on patients from a real-world experience does provide some of the only safety or efficacy information we may have on certain populations. We focus on a lot of diseases in the liver, and often patients who may have had liver transplants or have severe decompensated cirrhosis, they may be excluded from clinical trials, and looking at data from medical records or claims databases may be our only opportunity to really understand how patients may be benefiting from these therapies. So,
but of course, it would only be relevant for the comparator efficacy. That's already, you know, the comparator in the clinical trial set is already approved, not the new experimental therapy, because that you can have only in clinical trials, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's the case. But yeah, I'm making that assumption that a drug has made it to market and has been on the market to understand how the patients are experiencing it. So certainly in an earlier setting, we may not have that information available for those patients in these interesting populations, though we may try to include them in the clinical trial population.
Where would you see actually advantages of using real-world data before the first approval of the new therapy?
Well, there's some different approaches. So particularly in very severe diseases, oncology, for example, oftentimes in earlier phases, we see instances where we're working with single-arm clinical trials, and there has been discussions of methodologies using historical data to sort of have a benchmark for and a more rigorous way of doing comparisons to some sort of benchmark by using data from past clinical trials that may have been conducted to see if the results we're seeing in a current clinical trial may be effective. But there's also this idea that, and I think it goes by many names, synthetic control arm, for example, where we do potentially use some sort of data from the real world, where the timing of that data is obtained more contemporaneously to the ongoing clinical trial. So the assumptions with looking at historical data, there could naturally be changes in the population. There could be changes in medical practice over time that can affect that comparison that we may be doing with historical data. So the idea, if we could potentially use some real world cohort to collect information and use as a comparator in a clinical trial or as a comparator, a real world control arm to a comparator in a clinical trial, we could potentially do that. And there may also be interest in looking even if there is a control arm available, seeing how a real-world arm may perform compared to the arm that's in a clinical trial. I think other situations where real-world data may be used, and, you know, this may depend on how you like to define things. I think certainly with all of the devices that are now available, to be used in the clinical trial space, whether this is a smartphone or a wearable device, or using your glucose monitor in type 2 diabetes. I've seen that these kinds of data have been naturally lumped into real world data just because they're being sort of collected by some device that's on the patient and not measured, say, by a physician in the office. So that really depends on how you define things, but that's also one potential use of real world data. And I think for other questions around design of trials, you know, trying to understand background rates of events or background rates of certain populations of patients and how likely certain outcomes may occur in the disease population, and also just the geographic location of where patients may reside. That certainly helps with design aspects of clinical trials. And I think real-world data and analyzing medical records or claims databases can certainly be used to better pinpoint where these patients may exist throughout the U.S. and the rest of the world.
Yeah, I see that this is really a trend also coming in the industry from different sources, like the data itself and requests. As you see it in our company, that we've been asked to deal with real-world data. So we call it still a real world evidence. But so, but what, let's just speaking for a statistician. So what does that change for a statistician? I mean, we all know the classical statistician, the skill set of a statistician with statistical analysis type of things and programming skills and so on. So what does the trend towards real world data have for an impact for us as a statistician?
That's a good question. And I think there are a number of ways to answer it. I think certainly the data that we may get from real world sources may not necessarily have the same sort of what we think of as data cleanliness. There's certainly quality issues that could be observed in these kinds of data. And if you've ever tried to take a look at some of the post-marketing data from the FDA, the FAERS data set that they release, I think, quarterly to show adverse events that patients may experience on different drugs. There's certainly the information, there's a lot of missingness, there's a lot of inconsistencies in how things are reported. So there certainly is a lot more work, I think, that's involved in trying to analyze these data and make sense of them. It certainly has made me wish for the days of the simplicity of the data in clinical trials. I complained quite a bit about data quality when I was working in clinical trials. So I never thought I would get there. But I also think that one of the challenges in a real world setting. So if we're working in a clinical trial, we have a very clear visit structure. That visit structure documents what sorts of procedures are going to be conducted, and those procedures are often conducted whether or not the patient really needs to have them conducted or not. So, you know, when we get to the end of the trial, we sort of have all of our buckets, and if data isn't available, we can go into this whole missing data problem. But in the real world, data can come haphazardly. Some individuals maybe go to the physician more frequently than others. They may have different procedures that are performed than others. So all of these questions about having things sort of lined up in nice, neat little rows, it makes the analysis a bit more complex and trying to understand, what's the frame of reference you're trying to measure from to understand different effects. And certainly, I think the question about missing data, we tend to think about missing data a lot as in the pharmaceutical industry, and the idea that if you say that you're supposed to record things at every visit and it's not recorded, you can certainly think of this as missing. But if individuals don't have their lab tests taken, for example, and a lot of other individuals do at certain time points, saying that this is sort of missing from our traditional understanding of it in the pharmaceutical industry, I don't think makes quite a bit of sense. So I think there's those kinds of challenges. There's certainly challenges if there's multiple data sources in trying to link that information together, if it's at all possible, either using methods that can take advantage of patients' health information, or if that's not available, using probabilistic methods to link different data sources, say if we're talking about claims databases or death databases or some other sorts of data that may or may not be available. But I think from the analysis side, certainly the challenge is trying to account for the fact, particularly when we're comparing groups, that there is this lack of randomization. And all of the different analysis methods or way of analyzing observational data, just even thinking about propensity scores, you can match patients, you can stratify the analysis, you can use inverse probability weighting. And there's a lot of different approaches to analyzing the data. And I think that certainly adds to the challenge that, you know, we may not have spent a lot of time thinking about in the clinical trial space.
Isn't it also that the structures in a study setting is then also not completely, but a little bit different? I'm just talking about devices. So if the data is being collected by using devices, then, for example, usually the steps would skip completely the data management type. So that the data basically has been put into a file and hasn't, you know, there's no chance in querying, there's no chance in just, you know, getting what you said, like under the quality or cleanliness of the data to improve this data management. So this also like a piece where the statistician or programming needs to think differently in terms of let's call it self-evident changes or self-evident implementations into the data.
Yeah, and I think certainly there are. Depending on the source, there may be opportunities to query, but they may be limited. But certainly there may be questions that are sort of self-evident, as you say, in terms of the analysis. And there may be assumptions that you have to make that are hopefully conservative that you would take in the analysis and certainly document prior to doing the analysis. You brought up issues about querying. There are a number of challenges just with the data itself. Some of the data may be in a format where we're able to make use of it sort of straight away, but there is a lot of free text that's available in real world data, and certainly methodology is around text mining, and then natural language processing can help out with that. But still, it's a pretty challenging problem, because ideally what you want to be able to capture, you know, whether or not somebody had a particular event accurately, being able to do that in a reproducible way can be challenging. And there are, challenges also just with dates and temporality of things. You know, you may have something in the medical record that says a particular event happened between two dates or 2 months ago, and you may need to make some assumptions about, you know, what that date may actually be without having that explicit date written down in the documentation. So documenting all these rules and how you may try to make the data complete is certainly important for, doing things in a methodical way.
So in terms of these kind of things, I think there is this isolation that we had in the past in people that work on clinical trials and people that work on real-world evidence and observational data. My perception is this is going away. There's both worlds need to learn from each other. Both worlds need to get closer to each other. We need to be learning much more about epidemiological approaches. We need to be learning much more about extrapolation, interpolation, these kind of things. We can't rely just on the randomization anymore. We need to, we need to model more the data. There's a lot of different things that are now coming up. And I think it's a great, great time for statistician, because these are all really, really interesting challenges to have. And there's a lot of values that we can provide. But it just requires us to step outside of our, let's say, traditional area and learn other techniques, other approaches. There's a couple of things that you mentioned. you mentioned this matching of different data sources. I think that is also an interesting trend, because there's this trend of big data that we are, you know, that there's more and more data becoming available. And that then you need to kind of get data from that source and that source and that source. And of course, you don't have, you know, your unique subject identifier in all of these. And you mentioned these probabilistic matching, which I think is a really, really interesting area in itself. Can you speak a little bit to what that means?
Sure. And to your point about epidemiologists, the few that I've talked to, including my coworker, who you know, this whole idea of real world data, I think they kind of laugh about it because they've been doing these kinds of things for years, and it's only now that statisticians within the pharma industry and sort of within clinical development are trying to get the skills needed in trying to understand and these different methodologies. And yeah, I certainly think it can break down silos. So the question about the probabilistic matching is certainly an interesting one. So yeah, you're certainly right. Oftentimes we don't have information of the patient to necessarily compare them to match data from one database to another. But there's certainly some approaches you can take, you know, if there is the potential to overlap with different information. So for example, if you had access to a patient's medical record, you could certainly derive, you know, there may be information about when certain medications a patient may take, or there may be information about when a patient may be going to the doctor's office. And at least within the U.S., with insurance companies, there's certain claims that may be filed to pay for these activities at the doctor's office. So using information about geographic location, for example, and information such as gender and the timing of different visits, you can, between different data sets, identify records that sort of line up with a certain high probability that these records may be, in fact, from that individual. And there are some papers where companies have done this probabilistically matching, and they have had data available from some of a subset of the patients to know, in fact, when correct matches did occur. They were able to use some of these probabilistic matches and with a high degree of certainty, connect data across these different data sources. And in a similar way, they report it similar to how you would think about it in terms of a predictive model, sort of validating the methodology for matching. And in situations where they do have, you know, the matches where they're known, they can report on the effectiveness of this. So there are some papers about that. And these are certainly things we're looking at as well, because, you know, certain data sources, depending on the types of information, one data source may have greater granularity than another data source. And you can certainly get a richer analysis with access to these kinds of data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. The other point that we shortly touched on, and I think that we should expand a little bit more on, is the data that is coming from devices, and especially wearables, you know, smartwatches, smartphones, whatsoever. And my perception is one of the most interesting areas in that regard is possibly the diabetes area and things around it, because mm-hmm. there's so much data collected there. You know, there's sometimes there's so much data collected that you can't even store it. But it's basically you need to kind of analyze it on the fly and then just retain, you know, certain characteristics of the data, but not kind of all data points. So, and then gives us completely different struggles how to deal with data. And I think that goes a little bit into, this is then really big data because it's very fast. It's very voluminous. It is lots of different variety and something that we haven't dealt with as statisticians in the past.
Yeah. So I think there is a certain benefit to it. So you mentioned the example of type 2 diabetes. So I think the way it works generally in clinical trials, an individual will go to the physician. The physician will take a blood test and they'll look at the HbA1c to see how the patient is faring. So if you're able to use a device and monitor the patient's glucose over time, you can really see the effects of how the glucose changes with patients taking the medication, how it may change when the patient eats, how much they rest or exercise. So there's all these different ways in which you can see in real time how the patient is responding to the therapy and sort of what's going on in day-to-day life. But you're right, it does create this problem of volume. And in talking in one of our podcasts about this, individuals from Eli Lilly, they talked about analyses of these types of data. And, you know, if you are in a situation where the data may remain constant, say for a certain period of time, you may decide that, well, you're only going to record and store when a change occurs, for example. So instead of having, say, if you were to measure every 20 seconds or every second, and the value in a lot of instances is identical, and having to store all of those individual data points, you may decide that, well, I'll only measure it or record it when it changes, and then the assumption will be that that data point is essentially what it was prior through this certain period of time. So you've changed how the data has been collected. And certainly in analyses of genomic databases, for example, any instances where you may have sort of constant areas of the genomes that may not add anything to the statistical analysis, sort of as a first step, you can sort of delete those areas from consideration for doing your analysis. So I think we certainly have to think about the data in a different way. So, you know, if we're used to collecting a data point, you know, doing a test and collecting that individual data point and storing it in a data set, when we have access to near continuous information, we certainly need to think differently about how to store that information, particularly in a way that makes it easy to analyze. So the example with the type 2 diabetes is certainly one way that we can simplify that storage of the information. And there's probably a number of other ways to simplify that for the various devices. And but I think ultimately, you know, trying to know what data we need to collect, we first have to understand the question of what we're trying to answer, and then potentially we can limit to those data that will really answer the question that we're trying to ask.
Yeah, I think what's the interesting aspect is that it allows completely different definitions of endpoints that we have never thought about before. Because, for example, you could measure hypoglycemic events much, much better and much more precise, and have lots of different definitions about that. You could analyze this as you could analyze kind of post-exercise blood samples in a different way. You could, you know, look at your population in a very, very different way when you have these tests at baseline already for don't know, the last months or something like this. You can understand much better kind of what are actually comparable patients, and you could adjust for these and by therefore improving your precision and maybe coming up with completely new subgroups for which, you know, one therapy is better than the other. So I think there's a lot of new ways we can come up with. We can, you know, ask completely different questions to our data. And I think that's really fascinating. The other thing is understanding such rich data also, I think, requires new ways of looking into the data from a statistical point of view. So, and there's these, there's, I think, the rise of artificial intelligence is coming into play, because then, of course, you can use these data to change your treatment, you know, to increase dosing, decrease dosing, have these kind of learning systems, and that then pose completely new questions of, you know, how you set up your clinical trials, and lots of other things. But I think first, even understanding these rich data sets requires, you know, different techniques than we have, what we have seen in the past. So reducing dimensionally, for example, things like that.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point about, you know, it changes the endpoints in subtle ways. And certainly, I think one of the challenges with, you know, how we may collect data and analyze endpoints in a clinical trial, if we want to take advantage of real-world data sources, you know, we may not have the granularity to define the endpoints in exactly the same way that they were defined within a clinical trial, but we may get something that may be close, for example. So that does add an...
Or maybe even something that is better than is a usual clinical trial.
Sure, sure. You know, the example with the type 2 diabetes certainly seems like it would be a better way of collecting information. But yeah, exactly. But the consistency of the endpoints and taking that into consideration when doing the analysis, it's certainly something that has to be thought about. And you know, there may not be something comparable in a real world data source, and you may find that you have to try to approach the problem in a way that answers the question, but not to how we've done it in the past in a clinical trial, for example.
Just looking a little bit to the same topic from a different side. I mean, we talk now from the eyes of a statistician, but you know, just generally in the area of real world evidence, is there any other trends or any other changes currently than ongoing or expected from, for example, the regulatory side?
Well, I certainly think that's a work in progress. So the FDA released sort of their framework for real-world data at the end of last year, and they have released a guidance document on submitting real-world data to the agency. But I think there are some interesting tidbits in these documents. So if you do look at the FDA sort of framework for real world evidence, you know, the first thing that they reference in terms of real world evidence is this ability to do pragmatic trials and still maintain the benefits of having randomization. So this is perhaps an underutilized area of study design. So really what we're trying to do is design very nearly observational study, but maintain that benefit of randomization either patients to treatment, whether or not it's blinded or not, but taking advantage of that benefit of randomization for the analysis and limiting bias and things of that nature. So I found that pretty interesting about the document. And the document also discusses this idea of data quality. So whether the data are fit for purpose to be analyzed. And, you know, there may be certain questions where you may not be able to use real world data sources, depending on the complexity of the question. But there may be certain circumstances where these are the best data available to answer the question. So I think trying to understand all of these different examples of what's appropriate and what's possible will certainly be interesting. I talked with an FDA statistician from CDRH last week at JSM, and they mentioned a company trying to submit a meta-analysis to address one of the regulatory questions. So just pulling effect estimates from different manuscripts where devices were used and try to use this in a real-world data sense. But these aren't the individual data tied to the patients, and I don't think that was necessarily acceptable to them. So I think just gaining this experience, trying to understand examples where it's appropriate. And you brought up artificial intelligence and machine learning, and I think this is certainly an area that's going to be important as well. You know, I think in the past, you know, we've had physicians reading different sorts of clinical documents, but I think we're getting to a point where algorithms can read CT scans, for example, and read them in a way that's very effective and more reproducible. Abilities to pull structured data out of medical records and make better use of unstructured data in a reproducible way. I certainly think from a data perspective, all of these things will be very important, and sort of using these methods to predict outcomes, whether or not patients are likely to have a relapse or likely to have their disease worsen, being able to ask these kinds of questions, I think, will certainly involve a lot of sophisticated modeling techniques that can use a wide variety of data.
And there's actually this complete data science topic coming in, isn't it? So there is this, we are seeing people that are recruited into the pharmaceutical industry as data scientists, and they have very different backgrounds than, let's say, the typical biostatistician. And sometimes they sit in the same organization. Sometimes they sit in very, very different remote organizations. So, but I think it would benefit a lot when these groups would actually work closer together, would more learn from each other, because I'm pretty sure both sides can learn from each other. There's a lot of things that, you know, that we have, as biostatisticians, maybe have thought through very, very carefully and lots of discussions with regulators and back and forth, and where, you know, maybe on the data science side, there hasn't been this kind of discussion going on back and forth between regulators and the companies. Whereas they, you know, come from a very, very different point of view and are using all kind of different data to answer a question, and maybe, you know, more deeper into the data are willing to use different approaches to at least come up with some answer, rather than saying, well, we don't have the data for the perfect answer, so we don't answer it at all. So, and I think there's the other point that, analytics is used much more broadly now in the business. So it's not just for clinical trials. There's much more data and analytics usage in marketing, in sales, in manufacturing. There was already for decades, you know, a lot of analytics. But there's more and more this understanding that data is an asset beyond just clinical trials and these kind of traditional sources, and that we can learn from much more kind of data-driven companies like Google and Amazon and how they use data to in everyday decisions for their business. So, and I think that's another opportunity for statisticians. So step out of the clinical trial world and the, let's say, medical record world, and pharmacokinetics and dynamics and let's say these more classical biological background data into business data and these new data sources, which I found really, really interesting.
I think the siloing of all of these different kinds of expertise is unfortunate, because I do think there are things to learn from people, in the different methodologies, but also in different approaches. Just even taking a question, something simple like trying to figure out what covariates you would consider for a model or a prediction exercise. Somebody might, one skill set may say, well, I'll throw in everything, not knowing what's important. But another skill set may say that, well, what you're considering in the model, we should have some sort of understanding that, there is this relationship of these two variables, the covariates and the endpoint. So we don't want to just necessarily throw everything in the model, particularly if we, try to validate it and test it, that, the fit won't be very good. So trying to, learn from each other and identify the best approaches, I think is certainly a better way to go than to isolate all of these different quantitative people in different parts of the company.
Alexander mentioned it's quite a new field, or maybe a different field for the classical statistician. But maybe one last question, like from my side at least, is like, what could statisticians then do to prepare for these new trends or the changes that are coming along with it? Do you have any recommendation or anything that just in a nutshell, or what could be topics to pick up, or things that statisticians could think about or change?
That's a good question, and I try to think back to some of my training when I started as a grad student. So I had a linear models class, probably similar to most statisticians, and then I think we had one exercise where, using a linear model, trying to identify the best linear model, using this set of covariates and potentially considering interactions and, quadratic terms, so on and so forth. But, when you try to say, that is sort of the first step, a lot of these other kinds of methodologies that we're talking about with machine learning and artificial intelligence, they're just different types of models. They may be more complex. And we may even find out, if we were to run a bunch of different types of models, that, the simplest model may, actually be the most interpretable, and give us, the greatest insight. So, but just starting from that idea that, we find a model and there may be approaches that we want to take to explore more complex models, whether they're tree-based and CARTS, you know, one methodology and the various flavors of random forests that go into it. And then there's certainly the neural network type models. But I think there are some good books that, you know, can give a pretty reasonable discussion about all of these different types of models. But I think at the end of the day, they're just different flavors of models, and they require a lot of the same different techniques to, you know, assess the fit of them and see which model among the sea of models may be the best. And it may turn out that you may need to use several of the models to get the best prediction and sort of in an ensembling effect. But even with all of these powers and all of these different models, and some of them allowing you to use nonlinear combinations of covariates, there's a lot of limitations in them. You can't talk about things in covariates in much the same way than you can with some of the classical models and try to explain effects for different changes of the effects. But in the endpoint for different changes in the covariates in the model, it's a lot less straightforward. So I think it is possible for people to learn these techniques and get a good idea. And there are some intro texts that I think are very good to do that.
Yeah, one of my favorite books in that regard is The Elements of Statistical Learning. And I'll put a link to that book into the show notes. I think there's a couple of editions, and probably there's also now some similar books with R codes and then things like that in there. But from a kind of just understanding the methods, learning the foundations, I think that's a great book. And then you can probably add some R books to that. We have covered a lot of different topics. I think there's one other topic that I would like to mention, and that is prices for treatments. I think just recently we saw the approval of the most expensive treatment ever, and so there is of course no endless budget for therapies in our area. And so, Richard, where do you think that this will have an impact on us as being statisticians?
Yeah, that's a great question. Going back to the useful books, I think the one you mentioned was really good. There's one for Jump Pro called Fundamentals of Predictive Analytics that I think is also very good, and it brings in a lot of data visualization aspects to understanding all these different models. But to your question with pricing of treatments, it's certainly a record that we seem to keep beating, that it isn't one that's worth beating. I think every year we have an example of a new treatment that causing everybody to question whether or not, you know, the costs justify the benefits they are to provide to people. And I'm not sure what some of the, I don't know if I know what the best answers are to that. Certainly we see these situations with platform trials and trying to, you know, potentially explore therapies from different companies within sort of the same space and making use of, you know, a single control arm. That may be one possibility. I think certainly taking advantage of some of the real world data that's available to answer sort of some of the more easier questions without necessarily running trials, maybe, you know, one other possibility. And certainly the FDA in the regulations, they've talked about, you know, allowing the use of real world data to get secondary indications on treatments that have already been approved for other situations. But how is it in Europe on the European side and in terms of costs of medications? I know that certainly Europe does a much better job of assessing the value of the therapies, you know, to determine whether or not they'll be used by different health, whether or not they'll be paid by government health plans. But
yeah, I think that is a raising issue. And I think my perception is, for example, with ISA in the US, there's much more kind of similar thinking coming through in the US. And I'm pretty sure the systems that we have in place in Europe that look into budget impacts, look into cost-effectiveness analyses, all these different things will probably play a role in the US at some point as well, because you need to justify the drug costs. And for us statisticians, that means we need to be able to much better explain these drug costs, much better come up with reasonable prices for medications, justify them, have good ways to show the value of the drug in the marketplace. And I think that will continue to be a topic throughout the life cycle of the product. Because as you see new drugs entering the market space, as you see generics coming up, as you see biosimilars coming up, there will be lots of different changes in there. And I think we as statisticians need to know what's going on there so that we can take that into account and give within the company good advice as to how to best select the drug prices, how to best maybe, you know, come up with a pay-per-performance kind of models to help our cross-functional partners to have the right evidence that they need to best work with the health insurance companies so that they can best allocate their budget to have the best outcome overall. So I think these kind of discussions will continue. And especially with, you know, biologics, I think, because I think there's so much movement in there. There's, you know, companies that after the biosimilars enter the space, originators actually decrease prices quite significantly because they want to retain their market share. And that hasn't been done traditionally, and let's say for small molecules usually. So it's these kind of things are fundamentally changing of how we work. So it's a really, really interesting area and another area where we as statisticians can actually play a role.
Yeah, I agree. And so another example too, you brought up sort of payers and insurance companies. So I think the example with hepatitis C virus maybe 10 years ago and the treatments being expensive and, you know, essentially getting a functional cure of the virus. I think, you know, there's certainly a lot of challenges with getting coverage for the individuals who wanted to take these therapies. And I think now a lot of these payers are looking at NASH disease, so non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, fatty liver disease, essentially. And so looking at all these individuals who may or may not have, you know, what we think of as fatty liver disease, and it's all tied up with diabetes and obesity. And, you know, this is another chronic disease that may require a medication and trying to understand the benefits of the drug and, you know, the costs of these medications, particularly when, you know, there may be a large segment of the population taking it. I think it certainly has a lot of people thinking about the values of these therapies and what's reasonable given the benefits people are able to get from the medications, particularly when, you know, one of the most effective ways of dealing with diabetes and obesity and NASH disease is exercise and diet, and they don't have the costs associated with them. So it'll be interesting to see how this example plays out in the near future, since there are a lot of medications for NASH that are on the horizon for approvals.
Okay, thanks so much. We have already crossed the 1 hour mark in terms of our recording time. And usually we are trying to get below a certain number of minutes. But I think today we had such a broad topic in terms of trends in the pharmaceutical industry. And I'm pretty sure as a listener, you may recognize as maybe this trend or that trend that we haven't touched on. But obviously, we don't want this to be an 8-hour show or something like this. So, yeah. But I think we touched on a variety of different really interesting topics. So we talked a lot about real-world evidence as this really big trend and what it means in terms of us statisticians knowing about things like probability matching, for example, or propensity scoring, or how we could augment RCTs with real-world evidence. We also talked about data coming from different sources in our big data environments that we need to have different approaches, that we can't have the same rigor in terms of data quality and these or data cleanliness, these kind of things. We talked about data from devices and variables, how that allows us to enter into completely different areas of our research in terms of having different endpoints, different ways to measure progress over time. In terms of big data, we also talked about all the unstructured data and the text data that is out there that requires natural language processing, an area where lots of statisticians, including myself, have very, very little knowledge in, and where we can actually learn a lot from data scientists, which is another topic that we touched on, that they maybe come with a very, very different tool set from a statistical point of view than we are usually employing, and that there's a lot of learnings that we can have from both sides. And then in the end, there's also other areas where we as statisticians can tap into in terms of, for example, business analytics, understanding data that has nothing to do with biology. Finally, we talked a little bit about the increase of prices that we see here and there, and that we as statisticians can help there if we are really good in cost effectiveness models, understanding how budget impact models work, and these kind of things. And with that summary, I would like to say thank you so much, Richard, for coming to us and having this really, really nice recording with us.
Yeah, thanks, Alexander and Benjamin, for having me. I really enjoyed it, and I'm so happy to see the success of your podcast and see how you're sharing all these different kinds of leadership and statistical ideas with a whole new generation of statisticians. It's great, and I hope more statisticians can reach out to the community and put something as nice together as you guys have done. So great job.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Richard. It was really good having you here today.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. I really enjoyed it. And sorry again for being late.
No problem. Okay, bye.
Bye.
I'm really excited because we are in the midst of starting the Effective Statistician Leadership Program, and the card is still open if you listen to this episode quite soon after it gets released, because we are very, very soon closing the card to have all the students together for our leadership program. And then very soon we'll start with the leadership program. The leadership program is designed to strengthen your leadership skills in order to maximize your impact at work. And it's for supervisors and also and especially for non-supervisors. So even if you don't have direct reports, this is the right program for you. It's set up so you can do it very, very easily on top of your day job, because it's a mixture of webinars, podcasts, and moderated small group discussions. And most of the to-dos are really within your job, so you can directly apply the learnings. In terms of time commitments, it's just about 1 to 2 hours per week that you need to plan in addition to have the content. But most of the actions will really be in the day-to-day work. And I get a lot of really, really good feedback about the program. And if you haven't listened to it, just scroll back to a couple of episodes earlier where a couple of students are actually speaking about what they achieved through the program, what they benefited on, and it's just really, really amazing to me how mindset shifts, how the getting better leadership tools help them to become better at work and have a actually also more fun at work and a better motivation at work. So it would be awesome to have you in the program as well. So today we are talking with Richard. Richard is a podcaster himself. He runs the ASA Biopharm podcast that you can check out when you go to the show notes. And he's currently also the chair of the Biopharm section of the American Statistical Association. He has actually invited Benjamin and myself as podcast interview guests on his podcast already. So now we are returning that and we are together talking about lots of current and future trends within the pharma organization. And we are touching on a wide range of different topics. I've also linked a corresponding article that I found in the news in the show notes, so just go to theeffectivestatistician.com to find the additional things there. So stay tuned for this really, really nice interview. It got pretty long, but that's because there's just so much things happening at the moment, and please stay to the end. There's a lot of really good, interesting stuff in there. This podcast is created in association with PSI, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Just visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did. Please visit theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes and learn more about our podcast to boost your career. Also, check out the homepage of the Effective Statistician Leadership Program at theeffectivestatistician.com/course. And there you'll find all the details of the leadership program. And I think this is a really, really nice program to help you manage through the change that is coming up and to help manage all the different possibilities, all the different innovations that we'll have in the future and which we discussed 2 days in this episode. So, as usual, my final words are, reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.